I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
We'll have about 15 minutes at the end for questions. Please do ask them. He has such a beautiful mind, and it's a shame not to get to tear into it. I'm certainly very excited to get the opportunity to. For those of you who have read Who Killed My Father, you will already know what a compelling and moving book it is. For me, it is the perfect juxtaposition between a very intimate private story showing a sort of political nature of sort of humiliation and the shame of poverty. I was wondering, did you find this book easier or more difficult to write than your previous two? How did you come about writing it?
Writing is always difficult, as you know, at least for many writers and at least for me. So I don't know. I didn't expect to write that book. I was writing another book that will become my next book. In fact, the one that doesn't exist anymore. But one day, my father called me, and he told me that he wanted to see me again. And you know, when I was 14, 15 years old, I left my family and I went to the city to study, and I was blah, 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 the first in my family to escape and to study and to have a chance to do that. And very quickly, it became for me impossible to talk with my father. And not because we had an argument, not because one day I shut the door and tell him I hate you, but just because our life and our way of living and our way of thinking and our body languages and our daily life became so different, you know. And my father was a street sweeper in a little town in the north of France, and I was in Paris living my gay life and reading Peter Handke and Toni Morrison, and it became suddenly completely impossible to talk with my father. And we stopped talking. He had my number, I had his number, but we didn't talk anymore. And when I was 21, my first novel, The End of Eddie, was published. And then the second one, History of Violence. And one day my father called me after years of silence, and he told me, oh, you published books. I wanted to tell you, I'm so proud of you, and I want to see you again. And that was very surprising for me, because when I am a gay man, and when I was a child, my father would say that gay people should be killed, he would even say that gay people should be sent to concentration camps and these kind of things. And that's why it was one of the reasons of our bodies being completely split. And so when he called me, and knowing that my books deals with sexuality and other things, but also sexuality, when he told me, come and see me, it was so bizarre. And so I took a train and I went to see him in the small town up north in France where he lives. But when I opened the door, after years without seeing him, I saw that his body was completely destroyed. And my father is a young man, he's 50 years old. He doesn't have a difficult disease to deal with, like cancer or leukemia and everything. He doesn't have like a big disease that would destroy his body or cause problems to his health. But just the state of his body is due to the place he belonged to in our world, in our society. So as soon as I saw my father, I opened the door and I saw he had trouble breathing. That's the beginning of the book. He had trouble breathing, he had trouble walking. And I thought, like, what happened? And I felt a kind of an emergency to write that book. And that's why I started to write that book. And I wanted this book to be short because I wanted people to cross the entire life of my father in one read, you know, in 1 hour and a half, in 2 hours. I thought there was a kind of radicality in it. And I was, and that's how it happened. But I never thought that I was going to write this book before.
And so it's interesting that you say that sort of crossing your father's life in an hour and a half, because it feels like such an immersive experience. Like, you leave having completely experienced your father's life and really been through the nuances of your relationship. And it reads to me like part like a sort of campaigning battle cry and part like a love story or a love song to your father. Mm-hmm. And was that kind of your intention? You wanted to do something very political, but also something that was reflected on your relationship with your father?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing is, I saw my father, as I was telling you, and I decided that I was going to write about him. And I opened my computer to work, and I realized that I knew nothing about him, you know? And so I was thinking, how am I going to write about a man that I don't know? How am I going to do? The only clue, the only small things that I knew came from my mother, because in my family, like in a huge part of the working class, it was the woman role to talk. Talking was considered something effeminate for my father, so he would never talk about his life. We never had a discussion together. So I said, I have two options. Either I do an investigation book, or I can do a book with the silence being a constitutive part of the book. And so I started to write about these memories that I had with my father and this distance that I had with him. And that's why I don't know if it's a book, if it's a love letter for my father, if it's a book about love, but rather maybe it's a book about why is it so difficult to say I love you, you know? Why is it impossible sometimes to say I love you? And what I describe in the book is that someone like my father and many men in the social class and in the milieu in which I grew up, they were trapped by the masculinity. And the masculinity meant to never say I love you, to never express your feelings and everything. And so my father never told me, except when he was drunk a few times, he never told me I love you, you know? And I remember when I moved to Paris to study and I became a philosophy student and sociology student, and I met some people of the bourgeoisie, and I would see fathers hugging their children. It was so exotic for me.
Yeah, radical.
I couldn't believe it. No, frankly, I was like, it's so bizarre. Like, their father is so effeminate, you know? Because I had these stupid values from my childhood still in my mind. And so it's one of the things that I try to do, to talk about in the book, is about how the impossibility for a man to express his feelings completely destroyed the life of my father in a way. Because with my mother, my father never said, I love you to my mother, because for him it was an effeminate, feminine things to do. And at 45 years old, my mother left him because she didn't feel love enough, because he never said to her, I love you. And my father was the love of his life. You know, when I see him today, he still tells me, I will love your mother forever. And she left me. And we see here that love and the ability of talking about love is deeply politics, you know? Mm-hmm. Because maybe if our society were fighting more against masculine domination, maybe my father would have been able to say, I love you to my mother, and he would be with her today, and he would be less destroyed by his life. And so it's really this exploration of this impossibility of talking that I try to deal with in this book.
And you do so beautifully, I think. Do you think there's a real connection between, and like, I definitely felt that I read that and recognised it in sort of my own working class communities, relation between toxic masculinity, that sort of very destructive masculinity, and poverty, mm-hmm. and sort of the structure of poverty?
Yeah. Yeah, clearly. I thought that, you know, when I started to write books in France, and I wanted to write about the milieu of my childhood, because I had the impression that this milieu was never represented, or never enough, and very rarely in a good way. I wanted to write about it, and so I was looking for books that would talk about poor people, about working class. And suddenly I had the feeling that so many books, even some contemporary books, were talking about class, the way people would talk about class in the 50s and in the 60s, you know? Yes. It was very strange, as if history didn't happen for so many writers. Mm. I don't talk about you, I don't talk about Annie Ernaux, I don't talk about so many people who are trying to do something different. But, you know, that people were talking about class as if the LGBT movement never happened, as if the feminist movement never happened, as if the anti-racist movement never happened. And we should consider that all these new struggles that appeared in the middle of the 20th century, the feminist movement, the LGBT movement, and et cetera, are chances to rethink about deeply about politics, about social class and everything. So what I do in talking about the life of my father in Who Killed My Father is I try to build a contemporary language to talk about class in general and to talk about my father in particular. And as you were saying, I say in the book that in his childhood, for example, my father, in order to build his masculinity, And he had to build this masculinity, because if he was not doing it, people would have called him faggot, like they were doing with me during my childhood. So he had to build his masculinity, and to build his masculinity meant to reject the school system, because it sounded like a feminine and an effeminate thing to like school, to have a good relationship to the children, to the teacher, sorry. And it was a masculine thing to reject the authority, to reject culture, to reject the school system. And so because of that, my father stopped school at 14 years old, and he had no diplomas. And because he had no diplomas, he had very difficult jobs during his whole life, very badly paid, that destroyed his health. So we see here that the question of masculinity is a class issue. And so that the distinction between politics and class politics and identity politics, this distinction is an illusion. It's a lie. There is no such a difference, you know? Like, as a working class man, my father was, his life was determined as much by masculinity than by class. But it's not only that, it's two things that were, you know, put one on the other, but it was deeply mixed, and it was the same thing. And as I was saying last time here in this place, anyway, in my childhood, every single class issue was always a gender issue. You know, like to be a working class man always meant to refuse what appeared as the effeminate bourgeoisie, you know, the man hitting small plate, the man crossing the legs, and everything, like all our identity as working class people in my childhood was deeply a gender identity. So the distinction between gender and class is a lie, in fact. It works together all the time.
Yeah, of course. Mm. And I wondered, so obviously you're the first of your family to go to university. I read that you grew up in a house with no books, which is not uncommon for a sort of working class household, because you can't afford them. And also, as you say, the educational structure isn't always there. How did you start writing about your experiences? And also, though, because when we first met, we met in France, and I'd been asking lots of journalists, who are the great working class, like, French writers? And they said, well, there's Annie Ernaux, and there's Edouard Louis, and, you know. So that's why we met, because people put us in touch. And I remember saying to you, like, why is there not a greater culture for this? Because in France, it seems to me that poverty line, that the sort of the politics of class are so defined. Mm-hmm. What gave you the courage to write about your own background, even though you didn't necessarily have like a model for that, if you didn't have a model for it?
I had a few models like Annie Ernaux in France or Didier Ribon, but still it was very minoritary. You know, it was very difficult to find patterns, because it's a social structure. The fact that most of the writers comes from middle class, from a privileged milieu, from the little bourgeoisie, from cultural bourgeoisie, and extremely rarely from poor milieu, from poverty, from working class or non-working class or post-working class, you know. And as soon as I started to write, you know, I felt that I couldn't write about anything else, you know. It was not a decision, you know. There is a scene that I often recount from my teenagehood, when one day, you know, Le Clézio, the French writer, got the Nobel Prize for literature, and I was home with my family, and we were watching the news, you know, the very mainstream news, TF1, conservative, stupid news, and And they would never talk about books, obviously. And suddenly they were talking about it because it was a French Nobel Prize, and so they were happy and they were proud, and as if they had anything to do with it. And there was an interview from Le Clézio, and I was a teenager, and I remember Le Clézio was talking about the way he built this fiction, the way he built the characters, the way he built the chapters and everything. And I had this very naive thought. I thought, like, why is he creating fake characters with fake pains when we are here, like real people with real pain, you know? Why is he not talking about us, you know? No one will write about us, you know? If you are Toni Morrison, if you are William Faulkner, if you are Margaret Thatcher, people write about you, they talk about you. And no one will talk about us, you know? No one will talk about us personally, you know? Because I wanted someone to talk about my mother. I wanted someone to talk about my father, you know? It's like when you love someone, you want this person to love you. You don't want this person to love someone else as a way of loving you, you know? And it was a little bit the same thing. I didn't want to write fiction about the working class, and it would have been a way of talking about the milieu of my childhood. I wanted to write about the people of my childhood. And I know, of course, that it was a naive way of thinking, and I was a teenager, and so I'm sorry about that. And a lot of writers that I admire, Marguerite Duras, Toni Morrison, they wrote fiction. So I'm not doing a statement about against fiction. I'm just saying that me, with my body, with my history, with my past, I couldn't afford fiction. I couldn't do that. It was impossible. My feeling of emergency was too big, you know. And plus after that, and it came out as a surprise for me. I realized how subversive autobiography was, you know. So it encouraged me to go on, because when you do autobiography, you are saying to people who read you, these people exist while you read, you know. This suffering, this pain, these people are suffering while you are in your sofa reading something. And it makes the bourgeoisie feel so bad. And it's an important thing to do, you know, to address the people. What are you doing? What are you not doing? You know, what are you doing against this bad world? What are you not doing against this bad world? And I understood out of surprise that autobiography had this strength, you know. And I think that it's not par hasard, it's not by chance. If you just are going to publish a memoir, if Ocean Vuong writes about his life, if Carlo Knausgaard writes about his life, if Ta-Nehisi Coates writes about his life, I think there is a strong avant-garde movement today of autobiographical writing, because we are now realizing how powerful it can be, both aesthetically and politically.
I mean, it's interesting that you say about, like, the power of it, because obviously your book was just so globally successful, and I'm curious about how it felt to come from where similar feelings to you, to come from where you came from and to end up, say, here in this beautiful building talking to all these wonderful people, and then travelling around the world and having the sort of success you had. But then also, if you feel like talking about it, I'd be really interested in, like, sort of the response that a lot of the establishment or the media had to that, and why you think it ended up being sort of so controversial.
Yes, I mean... I was just writing about my family. I was just writing about my parents and about my past, and I suddenly realized that truth was polemical, you know. And suddenly, like, so many polemics started to fall on me, and so many things, because as if these people couldn't bear the fact that I was forcing them to see that reality, you know, to see the fact that they don't do anything against that. And it came out also as a surprise. It was extremely violent, this way of, like, these polemics that were created after I published my books and everything. I didn't write in order to do that. I understand that it can be a good thing. It means that people feel uncomfortable, and good literature should make people feel uncomfortable. So I'm happy with that. But in fact, it was, I don't know. But in a way also, I was talking about it before. In a way, I think that this violence from a part of the establishment against me, Not all of them. I don't complain. No. I'm a happy person. Don't worry. But the violence from part of the establishment, in a way, saved me. You know, because when you are in what we call a transfuge in France, a transfuge, when you are a class traveler, when you come from one class like you and you go to another class, at the beginning, you know, when I moved to Paris, when I arrived in Paris, I wanted to be like the bourgeoisie so deeply, you know. I wanted to be like them. It was my dream. I wanted to sit at the opera like them and to have the same body language than them at the opera. I wanted to have their way of moving. I wanted to have their way of speaking. I would have given everything to be like them, you know. And I think it's normal. You know, I was 17 years old and I was meeting people at school who would tell me, oh, when I was a child, we went to Vietnam. When I was a child, we went to Japan. When I was a child, we went... And during my childhood, I was watching reality TV 10 hours a day, you know? And I felt like, why do I have such a different childhood? And I wanted to be like them. And because they never accepted me completely, a little bit like Toby in the masterpiece of Alan Olinger's The Line of Beauty, who is an outsider and arrives in a very privileged milieu, and the privileged milieu make him understand that he will never be like them. He will never be part of them. And because they make me understand that I was not like them, I didn't succeed to be exactly like them, and they created a weapon against them, you know? Because I failed being like them, and now all I have to do is to fight against them, fight against the people who are part of the establishment and who don't do anything against violence, who don't do anything about inequality, who reproduce them, who don't care about poverty, you know? It's amazing. It's amazing how people don't care about poverty. In fact, when you suddenly go to, I don't know, to a literary party in New York, you go to a literary cocktail in New York, and you see that people, they just don't care, you know? They just don't care. They are drinking champagne, and they have a waiter bringing them a glass of champagne, and they take the glass of champagne, and they don't even look at the person, you know? I remember one day I was in one of these parties, and I wanted to scream to the waiter, but I'm on your side. I'm not like them. I wanted to just go on the table and to say, I'm not like them, please. And I thought like all the things you have to learn, all the body techniques and the body strategies that you have to learn in order to ignore people that much. You know, it's very difficult. I wouldn't be able to do that. I would break the glass and everything. And all of that, you know, I want... Because I will never be completely part of these people, even if I am not, of course, part of my childhood anymore also, but because I will never completely be part of that, it's good for me because I am a little bit outside, and it helps me taking a step back and to see how the structure works and to see what is going wrong, I hope.
And do you believe that informs your writing, that sort of, because I was going to ask, like, obviously that sense of otherness, your gayness, do you think that all contributes to sort of that sense of perspective, which enables you then to write about the structure as a whole?
Yeah, I really think so. In fact, it started in my childhood, because as I say in Who Killed My Father, for someone like my father, the world we were living in was obvious, you know? The way it was working was obvious. But as a queer person, because I felt excluded, and I started to say, okay, there is something wrong in this world. There is something wrong in the way it's working, and it's working in a bad way, you know? And so it really... And that's why, for example, I guess that my sexuality is one of the reason why I write about class this way, you know? The fact that when I talk about the class identity of my father, I talk about sexuality, I talk about masculinity, and I understand how much it was important and how much it determined everything during his life. Maybe if I was a straight man, I would have not seen it, you know? Yeah. And because I remember when I started to write The End of Eddie and History of Violence, in which I was talking about the racism in my childhood, the homophobia, the people voting 60% for the National Front in the village in which I grew up. Some people told me, don't do that because it's doing a stigmatization against poor people and against working class. And I was saying, no, I'm just including more people in what you call working class, you know? Because if you talk about, and if you write about, if you do literature about working class, about working class is not a good word, but post-working class, poor people in general, if you write about them, but you don't write about what it is to be a woman, what it is to be a person of color, what it is to be a transgender person or a lesbian, then you talk only about a very few part of this world, you know? So I'm okay with that. I'm in favor of minorities, so it's okay, but at least people have to be honest about it. And so what I was trying to do was to include more lives, more bodies, more voices in this category. Mm. But that meant to fight against a certain way of talking about class, a masculine way of talking about class. And as you were saying, that's probably due to my position as a sexual outsider.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. I sometimes say that I feel like when you leave, I agree with you, working class is like a terrible term and not at all sort of justifiable for all of the things that includes. But like it's like a hinterland. You're neither here nor there. You know, mm-hmm. you don't belong quite in the place you are, but you also can't really go back to the place that you are. Mm-hmm. How do you identify now? Do you identify as working class, or do you think of yourself as more in your present life?
It's a complicated question. For sure, it would be an obscenity to say that I am working class. It would be an awful thing to say because I have privilege that my father don't have. I travel. I am able to pay my rent. I am able to go to the restaurant if I want to go to the restaurant, and so I'm not working class. And as I was saying before, I'm not completely part of the bourgeoisie. So it objectively I am, but physically and subjectively I am not. And it creates this kind of tension. And it really depends, in fact, it depends on the place where I am talking, you know. And it's the beginning of Who Killed My Father, because at the beginning of the book, when I return to my father's place and I open the door, suddenly I understand that it will be difficult to talk with my father, because for him, suddenly, I embody the dominant class, you know? The dominant class that humiliated him, that humiliated us, you know? And so as soon as I see my father, I hate my body in a way, you know? Because I know that I represent something violent for him. And I know it from my flesh. I know him from my flesh because when I was a child and we would see someone privileged, someone with money, someone with culture, we felt so inferior, you know? We felt so humiliated, even if the person was kind, even if, it was like a sociological, psychoanalytical mirror. And we would say, I don't have that, I don't have that, I don't have that, I don't talk this way, I don't dress this way, I don't do what they do. And it was a constant objective humiliation in spite of what people were doing and what were saying. And so what does it mean to suddenly become that body? What does it mean for me? This is at the center of the book, even if I don't, this is a kind of ghost that crossed the book. What does it mean to become the body that humiliated me during my childhood, you know? And I see that, how much I try to talk with my father, to talk with my family, but no matter what I do, it's violent, you know? What am I going to say? If you say, what did you do yesterday? I will tell him, I was in London. I went there for free. My publishing house paid me a hotel room for free.
Yeah.
I had a dinner for free, you know. People were there, they paid to listen to me talking, considering the life that he has. It carries in itself a violence of the border between what some people have and what some other people don't have. And so really I'm trying to struggle with that in the book, in what it is to talk about and to talk with a man that I never really knew, but that I can't really know either, because how can we talk together?
Mm.
It's not about my experience, you know. It's a structural experience, and I'm sure you could say it's the same thing, more or less exactly the same
yes.
thing, and several people could say it.
Mm.
I want that. I want people to feel that. I want people to feel that as soon as I write about my father, I write about potentially their father, you know? And because even the issue of masculinity is not only concerning the working class.
Mm-hmm.
Even if there are some differences linked to the milieu, but anyway, yeah.
Obviously, your book's been translated to so many places now and has been received in so many contexts. Has it changed the way you think about class in France and like the universality of poverty and shame and humiliation that goes with it. Like, I feel like that's a very common theme in all of my work here in the UK, that desperate sense of shame at poverty, which you did not invite, which you were born into. Has travelling around with the book and seeing how people have responded to it, has that changed your idea of sort of the sort of universal sense of what it means to grow up poor and marginalised?
Yeah, like, I mean, one of the things that really surprised me while traveling for my books was to see how similar the situation is, like, everywhere, you know? And people always have the feeling that it's different somewhere else, you know? So when people interview me and tell me, but the class system is not exactly the same in our country as it is in France. But in fact, when I travel and when I talk with the people and when people send me letters to talk about their lives, it's incredibly similar, you know? So, of course, there are some differences, small differences due to the government, due to history, due to... But the structure of the society, working with excluded people and included people, persecuted people and including people, it's very a kind of sadly universal thing. That's the starting point of Hooking My Father, when I say that what we call politics, and in fact what we call society, is the border between bodies exposed to a premature death and bodies who are protected, who are privileged, you know? And if you are a working class person in France, you have 50% more chance to die before you're 65, to die, which means your life is finished. You don't do anything, you don't have friends anymore, drinks anymore, sexuality anymore. If you are a queer person, you have four times more chance to kill yourself during your childhood or your teenagehood. If you're a black person, if you're a person of color, if you're an Arab in France, you can be killed by the police. There is more or less one person every month in France killed by the police per person of color. So it means that depending on the body you have, depending on how your body is being perceived by our world, if you're a woman, you can die from masculine violence, like it happens all the time. You are exposed to a premature death. And for me, this should be the very definition of politics. This should be the very definition of what we call society, you know? What is more important than life and death, you know? Because death means everything is over. I mean, people in this place don't necessarily believe it, but I truly believe it. For me, it was so. That's what I figured out when I saw my father. I thought, like, he belongs to this category of beings. He's belonged to this category of bodies that are exposed to a premature death, and that's the story of his life. That's the story of his body, and it's very bizarre because in the public space, in the public sphere, it's as if the people who talk about politics are constantly hiding what politics means. You know. So the politicians make you believe that politics is a matter of gesture, a matter of strategy, a matter of responsibility. But no, it's first and overall, it's a matter of, like, am I going to die? Am I going to live? Am I going to survive? And so that's why there is this, what some people call the political part in the book, in Who Killed My Father, in which I talk about French politics during the 35, 40 last years, and how it affected the body of my father. But what I wanted to say, what I wanted to show with that book, is that for my father, a decision by Macron.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Macron or a decision by Sarkozy is as intimate as his first kiss or the first time he made love, you know? It's just part of the history of his body, you know? When you're a migrant today and you want to come to France and Macron refused to welcome you and his government refused to welcome you, it means that maybe you will die in the sea, maybe your daughter will die in the sea, maybe your wife will die in the sea, maybe your husband will die in the sea. What is more personal than that, you know? And so, for me, you know, it's a paradox, but in a way, this book is not more politic than History of Violence and the End of Eddie. It's just about the story of the body of my father and what happened through politics. The day that one of the presidents, and as you probably know, the French system is a very presidential system created by Charles de Gaulle, who was a crazy monarchist and wanted to be king of France. And Sartre and Marguerite Duras, Jean-Paul Sartre and Marguerite Duras wrote beautiful things about it. You should read it. It's a very presidential thing. And so when you have a president that say, we are going to stop reimbursing some medicine, mm-hmm. For my father, it meant I can't buy this medicine anymore, you know? So I have a headache, so I have a stomach ache, so I have pain in my body. And so it was just deeply, deeply personal, you know? So I don't care if people who read my books don't know Macron, if they don't know Sarkozy, if they don't know their name. What I want to show is a structure in which the more you are socially dominated and the more you are hit by politics, the more your life is determined by politics. I could say that today I hate what Macron is doing. I hate what Trump is doing in the United States. But when I'm in France or when I'm in the United States, what they do... It's not taking food out of my mouth. It's not exposing me to death. It's not exposing me to direct death. But if you're a Mexican migrant, if you're a working class person, it's completely different, you know? And so the more you are excluded and the more you are exposed to politics, so also to talk about the life of my father as a life structured by politics is for me a way of talking more generally about the condition of the poor people's lives, you know, of my people, the people I was part of my childhood.
Have any of you read the book yet? Yeah, isn't that end part where he speaks about his father in relation to the political decisions they make absolutely extraordinary, absolutely, genuinely breathtaking? My favourite bit is where you talk about, is it €5 a week they take away or €5 a month? Uh-huh. Is that right?
Yeah, no, €5 a month, it's Macron and his government. And since it's a presidential regime, Macron is the person that can say stop when something happens. The other cannot say stop, or they can be fired as ministers, you know. And so his government decided to withdraw €5 from precarious people, a welfare program that was called APL, which is money for poor people, students, working class people to pay their rent. So it's they withdraw €5, and at the same time they were cutting tax for multi-billionaire people, and they were cutting tax for people who buy a private boat and private jet, and when they were doing so, they were saying, "Oh, but €5 is nothing," you know. But I remember from my childhood that with €5 we would buy a pasta for 2 days, with tomato sauce for 2 days, you know. So for us it meant 2 days of food, you know. And it meant, am I going to eat for 2 more days or not? And these people are so disconnected from that. They do politics and they don't understand anything about politics. They do politics and they are so clueless, you know? And even at some point, I remember in my trajectory, when I moved to a small, but the big city of the region before going to Paris, the bigger city in the region in which I grew up, you know, sometimes the school would take us to theater. And they would very often ask €1 or €2 to go to theater, and they will pay the difference. The school would pay the difference. And very often, my father and my mother, they didn't have these €2 to go to theater. And the people that I were studying with me in Amiens, they would tell me, but even when you don't have money, you have €2, you know? And so the notion of nothing, the notion of emptiness, the notion of I don't have was deeply different, you know? And I see it today in Paris when I see some of my friends who are writers, artists and everything, and they say, oh, I don't have any more money, and we are at the restaurant, and I know that they are going to pay. And I'm saying, like, Because when I was a child, when we said nothing, it meant nothing. It meant that my mother would tell me, can you go to see the neighbor and beg for a couple of pasta packs, you know? And so when these people say 5 euros is nothing, it means that they just don't understand, you know? They just don't understand. And so for my, they call it a political decision, but my father called it, am I going to eat tomorrow, you know? So the notions of what politics means is very different. And my father is talking about personal issues. And that's why Who Killed My Father is a personal book about the life of him, of his.
Can we talk a little bit about the yellow vest? Edouard told me before he came that he was exhausted talking about it because in Germany they're just all obsessed. I've asked for one question, which I believe he's not going to grant me. So I read that you said that one of the things that shocked you about the yellow vest protest was the way that sort of your peers around you insulted the people who were taking part in the yellow vest protest, but that if they insult those people, they're also insulting your father, and that's why you decided to come out in support of them. Can you talk a little bit more about why you decided to support them and how that sort of fed into this work and your work generally?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. For me, the yellow vest movement was a space of truth, you know, finally. And, you know, there is this very beautiful idea from Gilles Deleuze, the French philosopher, when he was talking about May 68, the riots of May 68 in France. Gilles Deleuze was saying that when people talk about May 68, they say that it was the emergence of dreams, of utopia, of imagination, of dreams of another society. But Gilles Deleuze was saying, in fact, it was very powerful because it was quite the opposite, because it was a little bit of truth, finally. You know, people were saying, I want to feed myself, I want to have sex, I am a woman and I want to have sex with women, I want my body to belong to me, I want to have the right to abortion, I want to make love with the people in my university, I want to... And it was a very moving and powerful idea from Gilles Deleuze to say, it was so powerful because it was finally a space of truth. And I think that truth is one of the rarest thing in the public sphere. Mm. You know, it's very rare. And what happened for me with the gilets jaunes, with the yellow vest, that suddenly people were saying, you know, soon it will be Christmas and I can't buy gifts to my children. People were saying, I can't feed myself. People were saying, my mother is dying a few kilometers away and I can't pay to go to see her and to take care of her. And I was suddenly thinking, like, these sentences, politically speaking, are much more powerful than all the technocratic discourses about responsibility, about, you know, like all this lie. In fact, like our political conditions are full with lie, you know, full with this very violent hypocrisy. I don't know if you know this very famous scene from England where Brown was talking to a working class woman and she was telling him, I became ashamed of voting Labour because you don't do anything for us. And Brown tells her, no, we are supporting you, we are fighting for you, we are on your side, we are making your life better. And then Brown go in the car and he forgot that I still had the mic. And it's like, who was this crazy woman? And she was just a bigot from the Labour Party. And in fact, this scene was so important because it was like, this is how politics works. It works with lies at the core of its structures, you know? And so when the Gilets Jaunes movement appeared and when social movement in general appeared, like in 2005 against police violence and racism in France, it was a very important social movement, it was finally some truth, you know? So finally some people... And it was the same thing in literature, in a way, you know? When I started writing, I would open French contemporary books and I would think, like, what are they talking about, you know? In which world do they live, you know? It's not a world that I know. And so I thought that it was important, and it was important to support this movement as a left-wing person, because it was very important to create a left-wing energy and a left-wing dynamic in this movement, you know? Because when you have a movement in which people say, I suffer, I suffer from starving and everything. The language that will be used can be very different, you know. Do people are going to say, I suffer because of migrants and women's rights? Or are they going to say, I suffer because of the government and the dominant class and the inequality system and the way it works? I think that every single social movement is also a struggle of language and therefore of bodies, because the language makes decisions that will affect your body. And so I thought that it was very important to be here. Of course, I know that there were some homophobic things. I knew that there were some racist, anti-Semitic things. I know that, you know. I know that. I wrote about it in my two first books. And as I wrote in the essay, it was very funny because, or sad, not funny. But when I published History of Violence and the End of Eddie, I had a big part of the conservative establishment who were telling me, you talk about racism, you talk about male domination, you talk about homophobia in the middle of your childhood, but this is not true, there is an authenticity in the working class and people are good and people are good living,
yeah,
and everything.
Middle class.
And now, when there is the Gilets Jaunes movement and these people are revolting, they say, oh, but they are awful racist, they are awful homophobic people. And so at the end, the question is not what are they saying, the question is how they do to make people shut, and they can contradict themselves from one day to the other as soon as the working class guy, me, shuts up, or the Gilets Jaunes shut up, and they can contradict themselves as soon as we don't talk about poverty, as soon as we don't talk about misery, as soon as we don't talk about exclusion. So what I was saying, it was that I know that people are saying bad things. I know, because these people, part of the movement, are like my father, they're like my brother. Some of them are lost forever. You know, I had some people in my family who were ideologically so deeply racist, who would do Hitlerian cross on their cars and everything. So some of them was maybe hopeless, I think, but many of them, they could have changed very more or less quickly and more or less easily. I remember that a lot of people in my childhood, they were always hesitating between voting for the left and voting for the far right, you know? And it's something that you very rarely see in the dominant class, because people are either right, center, left, but they don't hesitate between two things that are considered so different. But it means that these people in my childhood, people like my father, were saying, like, who is supporting me, you know? And so that if the progressist people are strong, if they offer them a space to talk about themselves, then part of these people, and I believe a big part of these people, can move from one side of the political spectrum to the other.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree. I think we're going to open it up for questions now. I could literally talk to you all night, but I'd love you guys to have an opportunity to ask something. We've got a roving mic to say, oh, look at this, hands up everywhere. Yeah, you just...
Do keep putting your hands up and keep an eye as we go. Thank you. Right into it.
Thank you. Merci beaucoup. Thanks Merci. So much for your books and for this fascinating conversation. We talked a bit about toxic masculinity, and you described so well how gender stereotypes affect both men and women in the same way. And I was wondering what you thought about the importance of men speaking up about that, and because you're quite a rare masculine men voice talking about these issues.
I really think that anyway, like, it's very bizarre for me to say toxic masculinity, because it's like saying two times the same thing. so we can call it masculinity. I don't know, like, it probably come from my queer body, and the fact that since the very beginning of my childhood, I understood that I was on the same side than women, you know. And it's not by surprise, it's not by chance if many of the gay artists talked about women, addressed the issues of gender, like you can think of Xavier Dolan in the movie, Pedro Almodovar in the movie Milieu Field. And so, of course, I understood that I was sharing a certain fate, a certain destiny, even if, of course, as a man, there were some things that I didn't suffer from, you know, that a woman suffers from. And I don't know, it's very difficult for me to answer precisely your question, because it became part of my body, you know, as a lot of queer people, as a lot of queer men, when I was a child, at school, my only friends were girls, you know? Like, I didn't connect with the boys. I didn't like soccer. I didn't like the male sociability. And so my mother, who was trying to convince herself that I was not gay, would always say, he's so attracted by girls because he's with girls all the time. All his friends are girls. And I was like, but no, that's quite the opposite. Like, real tough boys have friends who are boys. And my friends were girls because I was gay. And so since the very beginning, because of this biographical trajectory, there was something in common. And so it's not even, I don't know, it was obvious for me. It was obvious. And also to talk about how my father suffered from masculinity, but also to talk about everything that he enjoyed from that. It's also important to talk about that. The fact that he was going home and my mother was cooking for him, my mother was cleaning the house for him. He could go where he wanted, and my mother, if she wanted to go somewhere, he would ask her where and when she would come back. And so it's not because he suffered from that he didn't benefit from that at the same time. And that's the important thing to keep in mind when we think about masculinity and the violence of masculinity. But it's true that there is an entire field of new questions also that opens about that. You know, in France, I am part of the Comité Adama that fight against police violence towards people of color, and who was created by Assa Traoré, a French activist. Her brother was killed by the gendarme 2 years ago, and she created the Comité Adama, was the first name of her brother. And she's going to publish a book with my friend Geoffroy de Laganerie. It will be published. It will be published pretty soon. And in this book, because they are my friends, so I read the book in advance. They talk about how it affects in the suburbs of Paris, where most of the excluded people of color live. How it, being a man and being a woman, affect differently your life and the relationship to the penal system, for example, the men who are being put in jail and who don't have access to school, even less than women and everything. So I'm talkative, but I think that there is an entirely new field, and that's what also I try to do with Hooking My Father. Is not saying I'm going to talk about class and race and gender and sexuality at the same time, but more than that, how can my knowledge of sexuality or how can my knowledge of gender can challenge the way we think about class, the way we think about inequality, you know? So it's not an addition. It's not an addition of several way of fighting of several, but it's the way that every single struggle, even if they have their own individuality and their own temporality, but how each struggle is a way of completely re-challenging how we fight in other areas, how we fight for other lives, how we fight for other bodies. And so masculinity, I think that today, if we really want to renew the class analysis, I think that masculinity has to be a very, very, very central thing, you know. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can I ask, in the circles you now moved, the literary circles in France, the people who are drinking the champagne, not serving it, are they more comfortable talking to you about your sexuality, your sexual identity, than they are about the poverty which you also write about? Which makes them more comfortable to speak about?
Mm-hmm. No, it's a very, as Kerry was saying, it's a very interesting and important question. It took time for me to understand the masculine violence and the homophobic violence of the dominant class. Because as soon as I escaped from my milieu, I thought that the privileged class were so much more welcoming to different sexuality. Which is in a way it's a little bit true. I mean, in a way it's easier to be gay here tonight in a literary event than to be gay in the village in which I grew up. So it's important to be honest about that and not to be in the old-fashioned flattering discourse saying working class is like anywhere else, life is like anywhere else. I don't believe it, but still I figured out so many mechanisms of violence, of homophobia, of and you know, for example, my second novel, History of Violence, is dealing with rape. I talk about sexual violence and about a rape, And it was very surprising for me to see that a huge part of the media, not a huge part, a small part of the media, but a strong part of the media, were doing everything in order to try to show that what I was talking about was wrong, that it was failed, that it was a lie, you know, which is a very basic rape culture, you know, as soon as you have a victim testifying, to put all your energy in order to show that the victim is responsible, that. And I would have never imagined that to be that violent, you know. I think that maybe deeply in my body, and I'm ashamed of it, and that's why I say it tonight, maybe somewhere deeply in my body, when people were talking about rape culture, maybe somewhere in me I thought that it was a little bit exaggerating, you know, because we don't understand, we have structures in our mind, and people transmit, pass some discourses and ideologies along to us. And even when you are the most left-wing person, you don't realize that you still have some social conservative structure in your mind. And when I experienced it directly, you know, in spite of the medical evidences, in spite of the destruction of my body in the few days after the sexual assault and everything, people were ready to lie, you know, were ready to say. And so it really took time for me to figure out that, to understand that, to see that it was a very, very strong sexual violence in this milieu, and that's what we saw with the Me Too movement, and with what was called La Ligue du LOL recently in France, where we realized that some journalists, so-called left-wing journalists from a newspaper like Libération, were harassing LGBT people and women for months and months and months, for years, destroying them, pushing them almost to suicide and everything, just because they were women or because they were gay. And so there are so many things that I'm still figuring out, you know? And so even if they pretend to be more open, you understand that it's just another way of being violent. It's not they are not homophobic, they're just differently homophobic. Yeah. And so I will have to write about that one day.
Anyone else?
Someone at the back.
So if you were lied, if you're saying that masculinity and maleness are the same, as a male, where am I to place myself, or indeed, much more important, the young developing men in our society mm-hmm. who have an identity crisis, mm-hmm. if you say it's all toxic, that's not helpful. I shouldn't think you are saying that, but where do you see the place of a non-toxic masculinity?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, you're right. You are right. It's a strong and it's also a very important question, because you know there are writers that I deeply admire, like Jean Genet, and who were obsessed with masculinity, and they loved masculinity, and they were singing masculinity so much. Jean Genet, in Diary of the Thief, in his books, he had a kind of like extreme fascination for masculinity. And so my idea and my ideal, and I don't know if it can happen one day, but when I talk about masculinity or when I talk about identity and what we are, it would be that masculinity is an option against among other options, you know. The violence of masculinity is because masculinity is something that is compulsory for a man, or you are being excluded, or you are being called faggot, or you are being called freak. And so I'm not saying we should erase masculinity. It wouldn't make sense. It would mean probably philosophically nothing. But it's to erase the violent part of that, the way of treating women, the way of treating queer people and everything. And on the other side is this dream of a society where masculinity could be an option among others, and could be an option also for women, you know, if a woman wants to be masculine and everything, that could be an option. And Judith Butler, in A Gender Trouble, really wrote about that. What would be the possibility of gender as a performance, so as not something violent, but as something that you could choose to perform, and an identity that you could play with, you know? And so, of course, I'm not... And I know there is, for example, in the US, a strong movement of criticizing masculinity and everything, and I think it's more than important. But in a way, like, I don't know, I would never condemn someone who is in a couple where someone is performing masculinity, you know. If the people are happy like this, I'm not a policeman. I'm not going to chase people and say, you should play this way, you should play this way, you know. When I have sex with people sometimes, I love to play roles of masculinity and of submission, and but it's a game. And so it became something entirely different. And so the ideal would be to build identity as a... and gender identity and others' identity as a system of choices, but I know it's a crazy dream. But we will try as much as we can. And,
amazing. We just got room for one more. Yeah. Bonsoir.
Bonsoir.
Donc, sorry, I have to think in English now. That might take a minute. I wanted to thank you very much, firstly, because I come from Mauritius, as does my partner. And
you come from where?
Île Maurice.
Ah, Île Maurice.
Oui, en effet. And when I was reading your book, I could see elements of, you know, my mother's family and my in-laws reflected in it. These are, you know, realities that are firmly anchored back home. And I think that, you know, if it's affected me, and I come from 6,000 miles away, that this must have, you know, le tour du monde, au fait. And I was wondering if that could not, in the end, sort of lead to perhaps like a global project of sorts, perhaps empowering other people. I don't know if both of you have any sort of plans for that, that could elevate these voices and perhaps encourage other people, mm-hmm. you know, like you, like me, and like, you know, other people who have grown up in these conditions mm-hmm. to write about them and mm-hmm. if that was, you know, in your projects at some stage, because you've been translated everywhere, and I guess you get these comments from everybody now. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
No, thank you. Yeah, I write because I want people to talk, you know, and I want people to see that some experiences, some scenes, some interactions, some things that they experienced during their life is meaningful and is something that deserved to be said, you know, because narration doesn't mean anything as such. The question is, like, what do we socially and collectively and in our society build as something that can be told, that is worth being told, you know? And so what I try to talk about when I try to write about is to try about things that are not often said in the literary field, to say this is things that deserve to be said, you know? And some people were telling me, so when you write, you don't have any pudeur. How do we say it in English, pudeur? Modesty? For pudeur? Okay. and I say no, because what we call pudeur or modesty is the border between what can be said and what cannot be said, and what I want to say is what cannot be said, you know. And you know, one of the best things that anyone told me in my life, I was in South America for my first book, The End of Eddie, and someone told me, it's the best book I've read about the favelas. And and it was so strong. It was so strong for me to hear that, because at my level, I remember that when I started to read the novels from Toni Morrison, I remember, like, they are the best books about my life, that the best book about my childhood, you know, because through the power she's, the powerful work she's building, the power of her books, the strength of her books, she makes me able to realize so many things in spite of all the differences, you know. And I hope that every single life being described, every single reality being shown up, can be a tool for a wider imitation, for people to talk about their life. Probably the gay movement would have not exist without the anti-racist movement, you know, because they were thinking, okay, you know, there was a kind of pattern, there was a kind of there was a dynamic like this. And also to finish, because I have to finish at some point. the thing is also, and I know it's not a very fashion thing to say in the English world most of the time, But for me, it's also very difficult. It's also very important to talk about what is not part of our lives. You know, to talk about other lives, to talk about other bodies, to talk about other people. You know, some people call it appropriation. Some people call it. But I don't see things this way. I really believe that. You know, it was at the center of my book, History of Violence, when I endured the sexual violence. And suddenly you realize that you have to talk about it again and again. You have to go to see the police, you have to go to see the doctors, you have to go to see the judges, you have to go to see, you have to talk about it again and again. And I remember thinking, why don't I have someone carrying my story for me, you know? And I truly believe that we are not responsible for our suffering, you know? When you are being thrown in our world, and people call you Jewish, and people call you women, and people call you faggot, you didn't choose that. I didn't choose to be called faggot, you know? And so if I don't want to fight against that, that's my right, you know? Why should it be my struggle, considering the fact that I didn't choose it, you know? So it's my struggle, in fact, but I don't want that to be imposed. And I think that there is obviously a very beautiful thing in carrying other people's pain for themselves, you know. And so if what they say is not true, if what they say is caricatural, or if only white people are talking about people of color and only straight people are talking about queer people, then it became a structural and institutional problem, which is a different problem. But this ability of talking on behalf of someone else, for me, this is the theory of the theory of Edouard Glissant. This is the theory of the tout monde. This is the theory of what good things we can create out of globalization. You know, Edouard Glissant would say there is the violence of globalization, the erasure of differences, of some cultures, of some language and everything, but we can turn it into something else. Since we are all linked, with new media, new languages, new ways and everything, this is a strong opportunity for us to create something new, you know? And so I want people to talk on my behalf. I want to write something and throw it and say to people, now it's your issue, you know? When there is a theater adaptation of History of Violence, I'm so happy because I think this is not my struggle anymore, you know? I had enough of that. Now it's your struggle. And this is really what I want to do with my books. I really want people to take my struggle for me.
Well, on that note, could you please all take Edouard's struggle by heading to the books desk there and buying some of the books? Can we all just thank Edouard so much for an extraordinary evening?
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.